Over the last 2 days, we've explored many of the trends in offices and buildings where you work. Now we look inward to office interiors. Kevin Capture is the Chief Sustainability Officer at the General Services Administration and Director of the Office of High Performance Green Buildings. Environmental psychologist Judith Heerwagen is a program expert in that office. In the final part of our special report, The Federal Office of the Future, they tell Federal News Radio's Lauren Larson more about the evolution of personal workspaces.
When people first started working in office buildings, the vast majority of people actually sat in completely open space with just a few private offices. Now I'm talking about turn of the 19th to the 20th century in that era. And over time, more and more people got private offices. And in the mid-century, around 1960 something or other, somebody invented the cubicle, and then we started shifting away from this kind of two-class society, the people with the nice private offices and the people with nothing, to fewer private offices and more cubicles. And that's been going on. I think the federal government, for example, was one of the early adopters of this wide open space with cubicles in it. And then nothing much changed for probably 25 years. And then we really started thinking about how space is actually used. We started doing measurements of how often people are actually in the space and some empirical studies, and realized that in many cases, not just the federal government, but private sector and so on, people just weren't there. Things happened. The personal computer was invented. We shifted from desktops that weighed, 100 pounds to laptops where we complain if they weigh more than 2.5 pounds nowadays, and mobility and the smartphone and even the cell phone. The proliferation of technology and the ability to work anywhere started really the current revolution that we're experiencing today. Judy, would you like to add something to that?
I think that's absolutely what's enabling so many different ways of working now that we never had, and we can't even anticipate what that future is going to be. But I think what we're also seeing is a lot of different models, organizations adopting different kind of work models and workplace models to fit their specific mission. I think there's much more interest now in how the workplace can actually support the mission rather than a way just to house people. So there's much more concern about how things that we do at work are influenced by the space and how that in turn influences the ability to achieve organizational goals, work goals of the group. So I think there's much more consciousness of the workplace as a strategic value and much more attention, as Kevin was saying, to how do we begin to measure that value. There's much more emphasis on show me the result of this kind of workplace design and why it's better than other designs. We now have lots of people don't even go to the office who work in lots of different place, but they're employed. So I think the model of the traditional office has just dramatically changed. So there are so many different ways of working now that it's kind of hard to keep up with sometimes.
Another thing that is also sort of changing is the office as a mark of your status in the organization. With this open office design, you might be sitting right next to your boss.
I think that's absolutely true, but that's very cultural, too, because, for example, in Japanese offices, the boss always sits in the middle in the open with the maximum view of the most number of people. And it's actually, if you're a boss and you screw up in a lot of Japanese offices, they put you in a corner. So it's something that is particular to the culture of society in general, but also to cultures of organization. There's a great story about Arthur Andersen when they were first starting to, and this is in their consulting group where they spent a lot of time out with clients. So they were never in the office. But if you were a partner, you had the corner office and you had all of these perquisites of your rank. Of course, they were also a partnership, so it was a huge expense. But they had to substitute something else for that to make it palatable to all the partners to give up their offices that they were never in because they were out with clients. And so they substituted other things like concierge services and parking and other stuff that cost way less than the space, but also were associated with rank. And so you can achieve that in different ways, but you do put your finger on it. If the organization continues to think that where you work physically is associated with your rank in the organization and your influence in the organization, That's a tough thing for people to change.
It is, and I think there is a real movement behind a lot of this for the democratization of the workplace, that you don't use rank as a way of assigning space. But I think there still are clear distinctions between management and the rest of the people that show up in workplace designs even today. And there are organizations where the managers really want to see everybody. They want these big open spaces so they can see people at work, feel a sense of importance that everybody's working there, and workers themselves like to see other people at work, and it's, you know, stimulating to see others. So I think there are both pros and cons to the environment, and JSA has done quite a lot of research in this area. And Kevin, do you want to talk a little bit about the workplace research on open plans?
Yes. I mean, we started really looking carefully at what was going on in the office space right about the beginning of the 21st century, 2001, 2002. And that's when we found systematically that the spaces, and we did like 2-week-long studies where we looked every single hour what was going on in spaces, more than 50% of the time, there's nobody there. And it doesn't matter whether it's a conference room or a desk or a little meeting room or a corner in the open space or a cubicle. It's like 50% of the time, there's nobody there. And that includes taking a look for obvious signs that somebody's there, but they've just stepped away, like there's a hot coffee cup there or the computer is still turned on and stuff like that. That's one thing. The other thing is that we did some measurements at different cubicle heights. And what we have found is that acoustically, when the partitions are low and you actually have some visual connection with the other people in the space, the overall sound levels are measurably lower. The other thing we found with doing a lot of measurements of people's reaction to space is that the biggest single problem in open space isn't temperature, isn't humidity, isn't air quality, it's acoustics. And we find that we use a survey that we developed jointly with the University of California, Berkeley. They use it in lots of other places, and this is true not just in government spaces, but in all open spaces. But at the same time, people also say that they learn things from accidental conversations in open space, by happening upon somebody, by overhearing something. So it's kind of like, yes, it's bothersome on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's useful. So from all of that, we've really moved towards rethinking what kind of space we have. We had one case study where 95% of the people who responded to the survey, and a huge overwhelming amount, said there weren't enough conference rooms. Of course, we measured conference room use, and we found that 70% of the time they were empty. So your temptation is, well, people just don't know. Well, and the answer is, weirdly, that they didn't know, because the conference rooms were not on a central booking system, because those are relatively new. Nobody knew where they were, and they weren't considered a organizational resource. They were like a local resource. This is my conference room. I schedule it. I get it whenever I want. And everybody had to have the big conference room for the once-a-month meeting where they have 40 people in the room. But we found that the average meeting size was 3.5 people. So we took the same amount of space, actually less space, reallocated it to many, many smaller conference rooms, and then put in a booking system so that everybody could see them, and then reserve some of them for that you can't book. And all of a sudden, the satisfaction level went hugely up. The noise levels went even further down in the space, and we got greater satisfaction with the way things are working. And the other thing that we discovered in doing this research is that if you don't start with questions, let's say you're doing some kind of renovation for a firm, you have to start with the work. Because otherwise, if you ask somebody how many filing cabinets they need, what's any sensible person going to do? They're going to go out and count the number they have and add some, right? But if you really talk about the work and what the roles of people are and how you're working together, we've also found that you can use this idea of moving to a new space is inherently disruptive. And disruption actually fosters change. So sometimes it's easier to make organizational changes, things that you've been trying to do at the same time that you're moving into a new space. And then it doesn't seem so bad to the people who are doing it, and they kind of accept it more. We've had multiple examples where moving into new space, people have taken that opportunity to digitize records, go to central storage, and all of a sudden you discover that, number one, you use a lot less space, but far more importantly, this kind of central storage and taking the time, all of a sudden, you don't have three partially completed contract files. You have one contract file with absolutely everything in it. So your ability to do legal research goes up, your ability to modify contracts goes up, your ability to communicate to other people goes up, and the cost of rework goes down. So even though it might seem like it starts out as a space thing, it's not really a space thing. It's a mission work thing. And I think that if there's one thing we learned in any of our research is that one size never fits all, and that you really have to start with how do people work, and then get the organization to think, well, this is the way you work now. Is that the way you really want to work? And many times we find it's not true. We actually don't want to work that way. We're only working this way because of some constraint that if we could remove the constraint, our work would be better.
I would like to add that as you were talking, Kevin, about it's really the work that matters and how you design and support that. And it's absolutely true that people, regardless of what they're doing, need times when they really need to concentrate and to be quiet. And that's the major problem in open plan offices and finding ways to support. And from research I've done and we've done with JSA, it's clear that people are very reluctant to ask their colleagues to please be quiet or to take their telephone call elsewhere. It seems to be impolite, but we get over that because it really is important for people to concentrate. Or you give them rooms they can go to and that they can pick up easily their laptop, their cell phone, and move. But work is episodic. Sometimes you really need to concentrate. Other times you can work with chatter around you. And it's being to work those transitions when you really need to work and concentrate and where distractions are going to really interfere with deep thinking and sustained attention. You've got to support that in some way or another because that's the key problem with the open plan. So you've got to either have behavioral things in line that say, no, this is not where you have your conference calls, or you allow people to move very quickly to a space where they can just close themselves off.
If an organization thinks that everybody can just look at a new space and figure it out for themselves that's anywhere different from their own, they're making a huge mistake. Thinking about it carefully and managing it is the single greatest ingredient to success in making a move happen. And it goes all the way through everything you think about it. So where's my new neighborhood? Who am I sitting next to? Change management can be done well. There's lots of people out there who know how to do it. And it's also something that has to be very specific to the organization and the organization's culture. One of the things I think that it may seem like a luxury, but it turns out not to be a luxury at all and to be a huge ingredient of success in change management is allowing people to practice. And there's a lot of ways to do that. In one case, we set up a space inside the existing space, moved some stuff around and said, here's what the new space looks like, and allowed 30 people at a time to spend a couple of weeks working in the new environment with the new furniture, the actual new furniture that was there. Other companies have taken a floor of the new building and let people go, you know, for a couple of hours and see what it's like and so on. It's also important to think about things other than the space and the furniture. I would say that it's exactly parallel to instituting a new software system. Nobody expects you to be successful if all you do is tell people there's an icon, you figure it out. It's about the people in the space with the tools they need.
For employees who are starting to telework, what are the keys to making that successful?
The real problem teleworkers experience, particularly if they're full-time, is a sense of disconnect socially. So we have a lot of catch-up calls. We have regular meetings every week. So we do a lot of stuff by phone and we use chat. You have to use all of the tools correctly.
It's a different way of working from, let's say, the 40-year-old model for how do you know your employees are working is because I can see them. My favorite story about this is Boeing. They started a telework program for over 3,000 people in the Seattle area. They spent 2 years retraining all of the first line and second line supervisors in the organization how to manage to work product and output rather than process and presence. And it's a different way of thinking about it. It's the way, of course, that you really should be managing people. It really doesn't matter whether you can see somebody or not. What matters is what they're producing. And so it's a different and better way of thinking about the relationship between the people, the work, and the organization, because it really is goal-focused and output-focused and work product focused rather than physical location focused. You need to continue to be connected to the kind of surveys that you should be doing to just see engagement. How are people engaged with the organization? What's their feeling about it? The most famous of these studies is the Gallup Q12, but there are lots of others. And those kind of surveys are important because a telework program is something that should be watched, monitored, managed, and measured. And you may find that if you're getting lots of odd kind of things with people being disaffected at work and, you know, not knowing other people, that you might want to sort of ratchet it back a little bit and let's have some formal meetings here in the building. Let's get people together. Let's all come in on the same day as a work group so that we continue our sense of community. And those sound all like very kind of soft words, but they're also very important in terms of how well an organization performs. The other thing that I think goes along with it is that it requires discipline on the manager and on the employee to make this thing work well. The manager has to make the time and the effort to make sure that you don't have an employee who's out of sight, out of mind. And the employee has to make the effort to make sure that they connect in a meaningful way and very frequently with other people in the organization and the boss. Those things are valuable whether you're teleworking or not.
Is video conferencing the tool that's commonly used?
It's becoming more and more commonly used. Over time, it'll get better. Even now, I would say video conferencing, you need a room that's set up with it with good quality equipment. So it's more of a deliberate, this is the kind of meeting where I need to see people's reactions. I would say, even today, that the most used piece of sort of distant communication is still the conference call.
This open office space, it doesn't work for everyone, right?
People do say that, and certainly the profession that probably gets picked on the most is law firms. Certainly it's not adopted in law firms in this country. I did actually visit one law firm in Australia, however, and the mergers and acquisitions department of that law firm had gone to completely open space and said that given the speed that they needed to work with mergers and acquisitions, that having it open, having that accidental hearing, being able to see everybody really made them much, much better at their work. The flip side of it is that most of the work that lawyers do is very, very solitary, and it's concentrated work. It's research. It's writing. And, you know, open space is not the best place to do heads down, concentrated work. It works really well for some professions, and it doesn't work well for others.
Research that GSA did that Kevin was talking about before, we tried to look at what was really behind all of this irritation with talking. And we asked people how frequently they engaged in talking in the, you know, workspace and hallways and so forth. And 50% of them said they did this frequently. So what you've got is people complaining when others do it, but they recognize the value of it to them when they do it themselves. So there is a real quandary here, but I think that the real thing that needs to be solved is people finding spaces when they really do need to concentrate. They don't need to concentrate all day long. They're doing things that can be done in a coffee shop, and that's why Starbucks is so popular. But it is a fact that they really occasionally and sometimes frequently need long periods of concentration. That's the problem that needs to be solved. And that can be solved by moving to a new place rather than trying to do everything in this open plan that is, you know, lots of things going on simultaneously. So I think we really need to think about behavioral issues here and supporting people's ability to move. They have periods of time where they really, really do need to just get away from everything.
If you think about it, too, Amtrak has done that themselves. They have the quiet car, no phone conversations. Judy said before, it's the democratization of space. It's a movement of less space for individual ownership of it and more space for collective ownership of different kinds of working arrangements, very small meeting rooms, solitary cells for getting work done, you know, where you can sit down, but also a connectedness sort of with the organization. People underestimate space planners, architectural firms, and organizations, they underestimate the need for a multiplicity of these spaces when going into a new space. So I would say more is the lesson that we've learned the most, that whatever your estimate is, add a little because you're going to be short. And then it's tough to put more in.
My last question, talk a little bit about other trends that you're seeing.
The biophilic design has been around for a long time. Actually, people have integrated nature into buildings. It has to do with our connection to nature and our evolved connection to nature. Since we lived in nature for a very long time, buildings are very new on the human history line, that we have an affinity for particularly places that are supportive of our health and well-being, which is healthy, rich vegetation, long-distance views, a sense of refuge, being able to pull away from things, and flowers and trees and water. All of those things we know just intuitively that those are good for people. But people are now beginning to sort of say, okay, this is something we ought to start bringing indoors too. And there's lots of work that's being looked at. You know, how do you do that? Do you need real plans? Can you have posters? Can you have really good connections to outdoor spaces that are indoor, outdoor? So many ways to do it. The variety of things you can do is immense. And I think designers like it because it just increases what they have to design with, and people like it. I've never found a person who says, I don't want to be here because there are plants, unless they're allergic to things. But I think it's really humanizing the work environment in a very, very positive way. And there's lots and lots of research evidence for the benefits of just passively viewing nature environments, nature outdoors, indoors. So it's just enhancing the psychological and emotional value of space, as well as adding stress-reducing benefits. And this isn't a fad. This is lasting because we've been doing it for a real long time anyhow, but now we are adding it intentionally into spaces. And a lot of organizations have biophilic design guidelines now and are really incorporating into, you know, what their consultants and what their architects do in the space.
I think the last sort of trend I wanted to say is there's a big disparity between the lifespan of a building, which is long, and the lifespan of technology, which is not. And I wouldn't want to predict 10 years from now what kind of technology I'd be using at work, or 20 years or 40 years, but I will predict that the building will be here for that long. So what do? We build for flexibility. If there's any one thing that needs to be built into any renovation, any new building, is build for flexibility, incorporate biophilic design while doing it, incorporate the connection to nature, but just assume that neither the organization nor the technology is going to be the same, and yet the people will be the same, and they're going to be in the space but doing things in a radically different way. And I was talking before this interview, and I was describing this furniture that people built back in the late 80s when computers were new, that had big arms on it so that, you know, four people at a little pod of desks could move the computer from desk to desk easily because nobody needed a computer all day long. Why would you buy this really expensive thing if you weren't going to share it? And of course, it's unimaginable today, right? I mean, nobody can think about doing office work without a computer. Smartphones are really the same thing. It's certainly within the last decade that, you know, smartphones moved from being a perk that the wealthiest people in the organization got to something that is essential for work. And in fact, you, when you're doing the interviews, have to make sure you got to find a landline because so many people don't even have them anymore. And so the technology is going to change rapidly and going to continue to change rapidly. The building needs to be adaptable and flexible. And I think that the building technology piece of that is slowly and systematically getting there.
And I think one more thing, Kevin, as you were talking about the flexibility and so forth, I think we're going to see changes in how the workspace is arranged, furniture, transformations of things that can be done very quickly so that the office may become more like a stage set. As you go through different stages of project, you maybe need to really transform your environment. And we're not quite thinking about that. We think a lot about technology, but we don't think about how the workspace itself can be rapidly transformed to meet different stages of work and different needs. And right now, everything is, if it's not bolted to the ground, it's difficult to move. So I think that Kevin's example of, you know, sharing the computer is a really nice way of thinking about flexibility of what you put into the building in addition to the technology.
And the other thing we found is that if people need a tool to do something, they won't do it. Sitting all day is actually deleterious to your health. So they like to work standing up a bit at a time. If you had to get out an Allen wrench and a screwdriver in order to change the height of your desk, you just wouldn't do it. But you have a lever. The desk goes up. It goes up in seconds. People are willing to do that. And so it's understanding what's going to make it easy for people to really move things around. And I think Judy's absolutely right. There's still way too much stuff that we put in our buildings, not just the walls, the furniture, that is not flexible. I really do think it needs to be much more like patio furniture. If you think about that, you know, where, you know, it rains, you put it away, you take it back out, you move it around, you have 10 people over, you have a different stage set. And this idea of the workplace as a stage set is actually a pretty clever idea. And it's important, again, going back to the people piece, is if you're going to do something like this, people have to have permission to do it. They have to have organizational permission. And right now, in most of the cases, we don't think about that aspect of the flexibility.